The Second Symphony by Robert Schumann. Born from the depths of depression and despair and a period where he was more or less unable to compose for the best part of a year. And it's almost as though we can hear Schumann freeing himself from those mental shackles to reach that hard-won C major ending. I am myself again, he wrote after he finished it, although it was only to last a few months before the shadows started crowding in on him again. We just heard it performed by the Mahler Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Daniel Harding, and for him, Schumann is his desert island composer, he said, the one he'd choose for company above all others, and he admits to having had an almost obsessive relationship with Schumann's music, which pays dividends, don't you think? And as he gets the oboist of the Mahler Chamber Orchestra to acknowledge the applause and goes through the wind section. Now, what about the playing? You can tell a great deal about an ensemble from the way it negotiates the scherzo second movements, tempo changes, the rubato and the phrasing. Seriously demanding. And, well, for me, the Mahler Chamber Orchestra passed that test with flying colours. I've just had the brass on their feet, the horn players. Now, natural trumpets, by the way, in both the Schumann Symphony and in Mozart's C minor Masonic funeral music, which we heard almost as the upbeat to the symphony. They're such a mobile orchestra as well. I don't think I've seen an ensemble this size which moves physically quite as much, especially in the strings, of course. It's like watching almost an amplified string quartet, the way the ripples of movement pass amongst them as they're playing. Now, if you've been listening to the Proms Artist Recommendations on Radio 3, you'll know we've been asking soloists and conductors to recommend favourite works, often linked to what they're performing at the Proms. Daniel Harding's first recommendation was, sure enough, Schumann, Paradise and the Peri, the oratorio written just a couple of years before the Second Symphony, and he recommends John Elliott Gardiner's recording. The other recommendations he gave us were Mozart's The Magic Flute, which is a perfect follow-up to the Masonic funeral music, that's Arnenkor's recording, and Alban Berg's Wozzeck, first performed in 1925, the same year Sibelius's Seventh Symphony was published, and that's the work that ends this evening's prom. Joined up thinking, as you can tell, and I have to approve of the recording as well, Claudio Abbado's, and he has powerful connections with this ensemble, having helped set it up back in 1997, I think. Well, our Proms C Major Odyssey continues after the interval with Mozart and the Sibelius Symphony. Paul Lewis joins the Mahler Chamber Orchestra to perform the Mozart pianoncello that he thinks has everything, number 25, Kochel number 503, and that Sibelius 7 to follow, a long, almost imperceptible accelerando, says our conductor. Well, while they practice their C major scales here in the Royal Albert Hall, we're about to find out a great deal more about Mozart's life in Vienna. Let's join James Jolly and his guests in this evening's Proms Plus event at the Royal College of Music.
Perhaps I could just introduce my two distinguished guests. Nicholas Till is Professor of Opera and Music Theatre at the University of Sussex. He's an opera director and author of, among other books, a wonderful book called Mozart and the Enlightenment. And Richard Wigmore is a musicologist who specialises in the Viennese classical period. He's the translator into English of Schubert's complete song texts and author of the Faber Pocket Guide to Haydn. Now, we're going to primarily be talking about the decade that Mozart lived in Vienna, that 1781 to 1791. But it wasn't the first time he'd been there, had he? He'd been there before.
Well, he had been taken to Vienna when he was a child as part of Leopold Mozart's general sort of policy of showing him off wherever he possibly could. And indeed, he'd been given an opportunity to show his talents, and he'd written a little opera there to show everybody what he could do. And he'd also been back in the 1770s, but Leopold Mozart was a bit suspicious of Vienna. He kind of didn't really think it was a very salubrious place, and he wasn't really pushing that hard for Wolfgang to get a job there. Leopold actually thought it was a rather backward place, and to some extent he was right at that time.
But Leopold was the kind of man born with a grudge on his shoulders. He was suspicious of pretty well everything. And it's interesting that the early travels, you know, Mozart trawled around Europe as the Wunderkind and later as a teenager. He made quite a lot of enemies, Leopold, and there's a letter from Empress Maria Theresa warning one of her sons about employing the Mozart family, who tout their wares around Europe like beggars.
So when Mozart settled in 1781 in Vienna, would there have been people who remembered him from the Wunderkind of 20 years earlier?
Most certainly, yes. And the person who Mozart was at that point most interested in meeting was the new emperor, Joseph II. Well, he wasn't new as emperor. He'd been emperor for a while, but he was newly ruling in his own right because his mother had died in 1780. Joseph was one of the people who he would have encountered before, yes.
Now, he had to involve, he had to engage in a bit of kind of shenanigans to get himself to Vienna. Could you tell the story, Nick, about how he basically got himself sacked?
Well, it's a complicated story, but basically he was taken off, he went off to Vienna in the entourage of the archbishop who had gone to make his formal meeting with the new emperor. And when he got to Vienna, he very quickly realized that this really would be the city where he could make a living as a musician and do make the sort of music he wanted to make. And he got increasingly exasperated with the demands that were being made on him as one of the members of the archbishop's household, where he was treated as a servant. He had to mix with the servants. And people started to invite him to classy social events, and he was getting more and more frustrated that he wasn't free to do this. And eventually, he essentially he provoked an argument with the archbishop's steward, and according to Mozart himself, the steward actually physically kicked him down the stairs. And Mozart did this deliberately because he wanted them to sack him. And the slight problem he had was that actually he was never officially released from his employment. The archbishop wouldn't formally release him. And one of the reasons why he was reluctant to go back to Salzburg for so long was because he was frightened that if he went back to Salzburg, which was, of course, a different state, the archbishop would arrest him and say, "Oi, oi, you're still in my employ."
So what sort of city was Vienna when Mozart arrived there? Because Joseph had been, as you say, on the throne alone since 1780, just, you know, a year. But, I mean, Joseph was one of the most enlightened in every meaning of that word, rulers in Europe at the time.
Well, he was the archetype of what is called the enlightened despot. He was the man who was determined to use his power to enforce a program of liberalizing reform. And he was impatient. He'd got very, very impatient with his mother, who was rather more cautious. So as soon as he had power on his own, he implemented a very, very rapidly a program of reform, which went right across the board, so that, for instance, he introduced religious toleration, he introduced press freedom, he lifted censorship,
He virtually abolished the death penalty, which
he did.
For the early 1780s was something quite
yes.
revolutionary.
He started to dismantle the traditional rights of the aristocracy, and generally he started to turn Vienna into a much more dynamic and egalitarian society, not out of any great sort of humanitarian interest, but because he had understood from his training, his education by reading the Enlightenment philosophers, that these kinds of social reforms were actually necessary if the Austrian economy was going to be liberalized. So he saw this as a measure that would actually release the energies of the Austrian economy.
And basically, Vienna became a sort of cultural melting pot. People came in from all over the empire. Yeah. What effect would have that had musically on the city?
Well, there was a very high level of musical culture there. Foreign visitors like Charles Burney, the English musicologist visiting Vienna, commented on the fact that almost everybody in Vienna was musical. They played an instrument, the quality of the orchestras was high, there was a fantastic musical culture. And there was generous patronage of music, especially from a small group of very wealthy noblemen from either the east of the empire, from Poland, Galicia, or beyond, who came from Russia. Count Razumovsky, later of Beethoven fame, being the most sort of generous and enlightened among quite a lot of aristocrats from the eastern borders of the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
And who were the sort of musical stars at the time? I mean, who were the composers you definitely had
yes.
to go and hear?
Mozart, yes, he was a born competitor, and he realised that, absolutely needed to get in with the court, and Salieri of Amadeus fame, the man who didn't poison Mozart, he was the biggest single figure as far as influence was concerned in Vienna. The Kapellmeister in charge of the Italian opera there. But there were a lot of native-born composers, people like Dittersdorf and Van Hal, and Haydn made periodic visits when his duties at the Esterházy court allowed him to.
I mean, what was Haydn's reputation? I mean, was he the big composer? Because, I mean, his reputation spread as far as England.
Oh, indeed. No, I mean, by the early 1780s, Haydn was the most famous composer in Europe, with only Gluck among living composers, and Gluck really had ended his career by the late 1770s. Only Gluck was Haydn's rival there. But Mozart was fast rising, and certainly by the mid to late 1780s, Mozart was extremely famous. I mean, forget the myth of Mozart being neglected, misunderstood, and dying in poverty. He was an extremely famous composer. In any review, any notice of Mozart's concerts at the time, you know, the famous Kapellmeister Herr Mozart, etc. He'd been a wunderkind who had transferred his fame into adult life.
Now, Nick, Vienna was a very heavily populated, very densely populated city. I mean, how did ideas sort of get around? Was there sort of a coffee house culture?
There was indeed. I mean, one of the things, and really a lot of these things were sort of adopted and transported from the model in London, I mean, where the development of the coffee house as a meeting place for the exchange of intellectual ideas. There were clubs, there were also salons where we can get lots of accounts of the sorts of conversations people had, and some certain clubs, certain coffee houses were associated with certain intellectual ideas. So you went to this coffee house if you were, you know, were interested in more radical ideas. You went to this one if you were interested in contemporary developments in German literature or whatever. Then, of course, there was a lively press, which had come into being as a result of Joseph's activities. So there was lots of circulation of ideas as well.
I mean, Joseph was a monarch who actually, in a very sort of modern style, and I mean modern as almost in our time, I mean, he went out amongst his people, he went to parties, okay, not any old party, but I mean, he would turn up sort of semi-incognito in houses. I mean, he must have sort of absorbed a lot, actually, by coming into contact with his people.
Yes, I mean, he wasn't always entirely happy with what sort of things people said and did. I mean, you know, one of the simple rules is if you do allow people to speak their minds, if you do lift censorship, then they may say things you don't want to hear. Mm. And, you know, not everybody necessarily towed the progressive line that he was trying to implement.
Yes.
So, you know, there was opposition. And one of the problems that happened during the course of the decade that Mozart was in Vienna was not just to do with economic issues, which we may come to later, because that impacted directly on Mozart's career, but also increasingly Joseph started to get rather paranoid that he, you know, began to fear that he'd really sort of unleashed energies and forces that he couldn't contain. And by the second half of the decade, he started to clamp down. One of the signs of that was his when he moved in on the Masonic lodges, yes, which were the best sort of obvious places where he feared that people were talking.
I mean, had the lodges kind of burgeoned quite dramatically from when he arrived?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, Freemasonry was perhaps the main kind of institution for the propagation of Enlightenment ideas. And it was very self-conscious. They knew that's what they were doing. They talked about Enlightenment or Aufklärung all the time, and their ideas were very much about sort of developing secular social ideas, although there were different lodges, and indeed Mozart, for instance, joined a lodge that was associated with a certain sort of progressive Catholicism. So it's wrong to sort of assume that all Masonry was as it were against Christianity, although the Pope had outlawed Masonry, but that was one of the reasons why Joseph initially encouraged Masonry.
As a sort of counterbalance.
Yes, absolutely.
Catholic autocracy.
Yes.
And so let's talk a little bit more about the Masons and Mozart's music for the Masons. I mean, yes. how did that come about? I mean, what's Mozart, in the music?
Yeah, Mozart became a Mason in the Lodge zur Wohltätigkeit, Beneficence, at the end of 1784. And he wrote a number of pieces between then and the end of his life. In fact, his very last finished work, was a little Masonic cantata. You might say he'd have written a few more notes of the Requiem if he hadn't been sidetracked in November 1791, just 2 weeks or so before he died, to this little Masonic cantata. So he marked Masonic celebrations. A lot of his Masonic music is quite jolly and simple and sort of even slightly beery. But then there are other pieces that are rather more like Sarastro's and the priest music in the Magic Flute.
Yes.
Have a solemnity, a kind of hieratic quality.
And would there have been sort of inside jokes? I mean, would the Freemasons who went to see these works, would they have kind of got the Freemasonry references?
Yes, well, the number symbolism, which of course we know from the Magic Flute, the number 3 and the number 5, and so there were all sorts of signs and symbols woven into Mozart's music, a lot of which we probably can't immediately extract ourselves now. Yes, those in the know, you can imagine sort of knowing superior smiles among the Masonic audience of which these cantatas and so on were performed.
Now, Nick, when Mozart arrived, 1781, I mean, how would he have kept sort of wolf from the door? Where would his earnings have come
well,
from?
Well, we have a very interesting letter to his father, written sort of quite shortly after he arrived, or quite shortly after he'd made himself independent. And he actually sort of lays out quite clearly what the options were for him. And one of the things that he says straight away is, because he has managed to organise a concert, and he points out, just for one concert, I earned as much as I earn in half a year in my job at Salzburg. Now, we have to take that with a pinch of salt, because he was trying to persuade his father that was going well. But we've got quite a lot of information about the economics of his concerts. Although it's difficult to be absolutely certain, what is clear that as an entrepreneurial musician, a freelance entrepreneurial musician, he was anyway up until 1786 earning a good deal more than he was going to earn in any court employment. So, I mean, one of the biggest sort of earner was putting on mounting concerts, and the way you set about that was you got a subscription list together, you got a group of people who were willing to put money up front. And we have, luckily, we've got actually a record that Mozart kept of the subscription list for one of his concerts. There's 176 names on it, which is a lot of people putting up 6 gulden I can't remember exactly how much 6 gulden is, but it's a significant amount of money. Enough money for him to be able to, you know he can sign the contract with the concert venue, and he can start issuing contracts to the musicians who need to play. If we look at that list of names, they are all of the prominent people in Vienna at that date. Government administrators, military figures, great landowning aristocrats, a few sort of upper middle class people. But he was very well connected. He knew exactly how to sort of, you know, organize that sort of thing. His other source of income that he complains about, but it was a very reliable source of income, and he talks to his father about, is giving piano lessons to usually the daughters of the aristocracy. It was thought to be something that any young woman should have as a talent to be able to play the piano.
There were some very good players.
Amongst them. And then there were one or two, there was one he complains about, actually not in Vienna, but on another occasion. He says she's fat and sweaty, and she made a pass at him, and he wasn't very pleased
Joseph
about that.
Von Auenhammer, yes, for whom wrote the two
yes.
pianos.
Yeah. But that was a very important part of his income. And then the third thing was making deals with publishers to publish chamber music mainly. And so he had to sort of set about getting contracts with publishers for his chamber music. And those are really the three main entrepreneurial ways in which he earned his money. The fourth thing he was always angling for, always hanging in for, was some sort of salaried position. Not a sort of, you know, one like a sort of permanent full-time court appointment, but something that would give him a bit of security. Obviously, ideally in the court itself from the emperor, but there were other aristocrats who retained musicians on an occasional basis. And he had a few options there that he was looking for. And then, actually, the other thing was simply playing in aristocratic salons. We've got a list of one, in one letter, he details all of the concerts he does over about 5 weeks. And that ranges from the subscription concerts, bib subscription concerts, to concerts in the theatre. And then almost every other evening, he is at some member of the aristocracy's household where he would have been performing and being paid.
And presumably, gold snuff box.
And Richard, when you know, when he was out performing, he would have been playing his own music. I mean, it was back then unusual to play someone else's
People
music.
People wanted new music. They want absolutely up-to-date music. And Mozart overwhelmingly played his own music. But I can't think of any recorded evidence that Mozart played other people's music at the keyboard. You know, he wrote the best keyboard music. He was perfectly aware of that. As a born competitor, he knew that he'd licked the opposition in Vienna, and especially the great series of piano concertos, of which we're going to hear the last, number 25 in C, from composed between 1784 and 1786. Mozart would promote himself in the triple role of impresario, as Nick said, booking the musicians, getting the aristocrat subscribers to underwrite the concert, and then displaying his newest piano concerto in his own dazzling performance. Quite often as well, improvising a certain amount as he went along. The original manuscripts were often very sketchy, and a lot of filling in had to be done, and Mozart was just the man, of course, to fill in.
Now things went sort of soured a little bit towards the end of the 80s. War descended, money was tighter. I mean, did that change the sort of atmosphere in Vienna a lot?
Well, yes. Joseph had been negotiating a long time with the Russians secretly to cobble together a deal to re-engage the Turks in war, basically because the Turks were known to be weak, and Joseph and the Russians thought that they could grab some bits of territory from the Turks. And it proved to be a great mistake. It was extremely costly. Taxes went up. A lot of the aristocracy actually were required to go to the front, as indeed Joseph as well did. So life in Vienna got tough. Nice. And I mean, famously, in 1789, I mean, the war started in 1787, but Mozart's fortunes really had been declining from that point in terms of sort of his public life as a composer. And famously, when he tried to resuscitate the subscription concerts in 1789, he couldn't get any signatories. He couldn't get anyone to sign up, so he had to cancel the proposed subscription series, which is a very clear indicator of the shift that had taken place. Yes.
And Richard, what about the French Revolution? Because, you know, things were seething and writhing in France. And one thing we've not mentioned is that Marie Antoinette was Joseph's sister.
Yes.
I mean, that must have had an effect.
Well, it had a huge effect on Austrian life generally. And it's possible, it's almost certain, that in his Masonic meetings, for example, which he attended for a time pretty regularly, questions of what was going on in France would have been discussed. But Mozart was overwhelmingly a musician and lived so much of his life, you feel, in a bubble. So there are no statements from Mozart himself on the state of affairs in France.
Richard Wigmore, Nicholas Till, thank you very much.
Presenter James Jolly recorded earlier this evening at the Proms Plus event in the Royal College of Music, which was produced by Brian Jackson. And there's a Proms Plus event before every prom this season. They all finish in plenty of time for you to get to the concert itself, so if you're going to the proms, do look them up and see what's going on in the Proms Guide or on the BBC Proms website. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, home of the proms. I'm Andrew McGregor. Welcome back to the second half of this evening's concert live at the Royal Albert Hall, where the key of C is the major topic of musical conversation. Daniel Harding is conducting the Mahler Chamber Orchestra, and they're going to be joined in a moment by pianist Paul Lewis for one of Mozart's late great piano concertos, number 25 in C major, Kochel number 503, after which there's Finnish composer Jean Sibelius' last surviving symphony, number 7, which fuses the separate movements of the traditional symphony into a single, slowly evolving and accelerating entity, rooted in C major. Loud applauses for the members of the Mahler Chamber Orchestra returning to the platform.
they reformed, well, they evolved really from the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra, and they now have annual residences in Ferrara and Lucerne, where they form the core of Claudio Abbado's Lucerne Festival Orchestra. Players from all over, not just Europe, but the United States, China, just about every corner of the world. And Daniel Harding knows just what makes them special.
The Mahler Box is special because they play so well. It's that simple. You can be young and you can be full of enthusiasm and you can be idealistic and you can be all these things, and that's great. But it's also kind of wonderful when people play really, really well. And this is an orchestra where the awareness that, you know, if something happens in the orchestra, everybody is aware that it's happened, everybody reacts to it, everyone takes it and runs with it. It's this feeling of chamber music.
By the way, each of the string players has two bows with them this evening, a modern bow for the Schumann and Sibelius symphonies and the straighter, slightly softer classical bows for this Mozart piano concerto we're about to hear. Daniel Harding was telling me it's not so much about an idea of authenticity, but rather because it helps them with what he calls the gestures in the classical works, the kind of micro-phrasing that comes as part and parcel of using the earlier type of bow. And Paul Lewis certainly appreciates the subtle difference it makes to the sound of the concerto. I asked him during the rehearsal today why this C major Mozart concerto, K503, was a particular favourite.
There are many special Mozart concertos, but this one, for me, is particularly special because I just think this piece has everything. You're aware right from the start that it has this big symphonic character, perhaps more so than some of the others. But in addition to that, you know, you see so many different sides of Mozart. You see the operatic side. There's a real sense of the operatic about this. There's a lot of humour in it, especially in the last movement. And a lot of chamber music, too. There's a real interaction between what the piano does and the solo winds, and you have to have a good idea of that, especially in the slow movement, where I think it really does feel like chamber music. I mean, Mozart concertos in general have to feel like big chamber music, and one of the challenges is trying to find that balance between being soloistic and being a team player. And that's particularly relevant in this piece.
And we know they're playing with classical bows, the string players here. It's a very clean, light, almost vibrato-free sound. How much of an impact does it have on the way you play the work?
I think it has an impact because obviously you're reacting to what you're hearing all the time. Even if you're not trying to adjust your playing, you know, I think it happens to some extent automatically, but of course one wants to match as far as one can, which is sometimes a challenge with, you know, the modern Steinway, but at least that instrument can give you, it gives you so many possibilities. There's such a range there that you can find your colour somewhere within that.
Paul Lewis talking to me earlier today during the rehearsal for this evening's concert. Well, Candida Thompson, who's leading this evening, has tuned the orchestra in his. Our soloist Paul Lewis with conductor Daniel Harding joining the Mahler Chamber Orchestra on stage at the Albert Hall for Mozart's C major piano concerto, Kirche No. 503, which has one of the most symphonic openings of any Mozart concerto, as you're about to hear for yourself.
Thank you.
Mozart's C major piano concerto, Koka number 503, number 25 if you prefer, the longest and one of the greatest of all his piano concertos. That's certainly the view of this evening's soloist, Paul Lewis. And the second he finished playing, he leapt up from the piano stool and there was a warm embrace between himself and conductor Daniel Harding. They link hands and applaud one another. Handshake for Candida Thompson, who's leading the Mahler Chamber Orchestra this evening. I didn't mention the cadenzas before we heard the concerto. There aren't any surviving Mozart originals. Paul Lewis played those by his teacher and mentor, Alfred Brendel. He told me it was the earlier Brendel cadenzas from the 1970s. I think he's modified the first movement cadenza himself. Now, it seems to be hinting a little bit at the Marseillaise. And while you might know Paul better for his Beethoven and Schubert in concert and on record, but the intimacy and emotional intensity of those exchanges with the players and demonstrated exactly what he was telling us beforehand about this concerto, that combination of symphonic grandeur, intimacy, the chamber music qualities that all the Mozart concertos need and that he finds in abundance with this ensemble. Well, here he is back at the front of the stage here at the Royal Albert Hall. Cheers from the audience. Applause, tapping of bows from the members of the Mahler Chamber Orchestra. And Daniel Harding brings the principal flautist to her feet, a little reluctantly, I have to say, to acknowledge the applause for her contribution in the concerto. That's Chiara Tonelli from Italy. They link hands again, soloist and conductor bowing to the promenaders. They gave almost the same concert together a few days ago in Siena, and Paul is just back from the Tanglewood Festival. He's crossing the Atlantic again in a few days' time to play the same C major Mozart concerto in New York City with the Mostly Mozart Festival Orchestra in Avery Fisher Hall. And he's back in the UK for another great C major work, Schubert's Grand Duo with Imogen Cooper, which we'll be hearing here at the BBC Proms on the 5th of September. Well, after the exuberant heroic C major ending of that Mozart concerto, the stage here at the Royal Albert Hall is about to be reset for our second C major symphony of the evening, Jean Sibelius's 7th symphony. By the way, I ought to mention that we have BBC 4's cameras in the hall with us this evening. It's going to be part of this week's broadcast from the Proms this Thursday evening, if all goes to plan. Don't forget the televisual Proms coverage every Thursday, Friday and Sunday evenings throughout the season. Sibelius's 7th was his last published symphony, finished in 1924, just before an almost complete compositional silence fell. After the 7th came incidental music for The Tempest, then his tone poem Tapiola, then nothing for the last 30 years of Sibelius's life. He did write an 8th symphony, it's thought, but then destroyed it. What would you pay to know how that sounded after the extreme originality of the 7th symphony? Well, a decade before he wrote it, Sibelius had likened the symphonic form to a river born from various rivulets that seek each other until it proceeds wide and powerful towards the sea. And the 7th Symphony is perhaps the supreme example of the way in which Sibelius allows ideas to coalesce and evolve in a single movement. Daniel Harding has his own ideas about what it might all mean.
You know, it's almost as if these first three notes on the timpani, it's like the Big Bang. I mean, there's this kind of this tiny thing that happens and everything comes out of it. It just goes forwards and forwards and forwards. In the literal sense that it's one of the longest and most subtle accelerandos in music. There are references to things that came before, but basically it's constant invention. And the ending, it's as if, you know, like the river just opens up into the ocean. It just opens and it remains open. I mean, it's a very inconclusive ending in one sense, and another sense it's absolutely what you need. Great composers often do that. They take you on the journey and you think, how on earth? It's like the great taxi drivers. I'm never going to get where I've asked to go. And then you come round this corner and suddenly you're there, and this is a wonderful feeling. And I think Sibelius does a little bit of that. But he was very reluctant to ever talk about what his music was about. I don't make national stereotypes, but he did come from Finland. But it's clearly about a lot, and it's clearly about very important things. He and his wife, they lost a daughter, I think. And for me, there's some echoes of other pieces which come from that time. And there's this beautiful fragility. We think sometimes of Sibelius as being a kind of, almost a kind of alpine muscular composer. I mean, some of the more famous moments have some of that quality. But there's an incredible, kind of impossible to know, inscrutable quality. And just before the end of this piece, there's this very, very fragile kind of moonlit music. I can only imagine him and his wife kind of in old age. It's a dance. I mean, it's the most beautifully fragile dance, but seems to be a reminiscence of what it was like to be young.
There is a sort of ray of C major sunlight at the end.
Yeah.
To you, moonlight?
I don't hear that much sunshine at the end, or sunlight. Some people find great beauty in mystery. I find a lot of beauty in trying to figure things out and to understand them. But I think that in this music, a certain amount of mystery goes a very long way.
Daniel Harding talking to me earlier about Sibelius's Seventh Symphony. It goes a very long way, but I mean, it doesn't take that long to perform, just under 25 minutes for this single movement span, this symphonic evolution that Sibelius called a Fantasia Sinfonica to start off with, but then later settled on the Seventh Symphony. Well, here's the Mahler Chamber Orchestra's conductor laureate, Daniel Harding, to begin the journey that took Sibelius 10 years to create, his Symphony No. 7.
The end of an enigmatic masterpiece, the Symphony No. 7 in C major by Jean Sibelius. His last published symphony from 1924, performed for us here at the BBC Proms by the Mahler Chamber Orchestra and its former principal conductor and music director, Daniel Harding, now the orchestra's conductor laureate, just walking off the platform. I think Sibelius himself said something about the moon seen through swirling storm clouds, and there were certainly moments towards the end of the symphony where that seems an absolutely appropriate analogy. And the seventh seems to have started as an adagio motif in a sketchbook 10 years before the symphony was finally finished. Joy of life and vitality mixed with Appassionato, who wrote about it years before he finished it. Here's Daniel Harding once again. And we're getting the solo calls from members of the orchestra. Trombone, the horn players. And it's, 45 core members of the Mahler Chamber Orchestra, 20 different countries represented, but quite a few Brits amongst them. Not just leader Candida Thompson, there are 9 altogether, plus a lone Irish bassoonist, Peter Whelan. And they're all on their feet now, acknowledging the applause. And Daniel Harding, he's such a slim, slight, well, he looks still like a postgraduate music student in rehearsals today, and dressed in jeans and a grey hoodie, and more like a dapper young executive in his dark grey suit and tie for the concert. I think it's actually 10 years since Daniel Harding's last prom. I hope we don't have to wait another decade for his next appearance here with the Mahler Chamber Orchestra. I was just looking at the programme book, actually, and it quotes composer and writer Robert Simpson on Sibelius' Seventh Symphony. "The work's like a great planet in orbit," he wrote. "Sometimes we're out in space observing its awesome progress around the sun. Sometimes we're the little active creatures on its surface, aware only of our own muscular energy, and not at all of the diurnal movement of the Earth itself." Robert Simpson on Sibelius 7. Daniel Harding back on the platform, in the middle of the players, bowing to the promenaders. And now to the orchestra, showing his thanks to them for their performances this evening. Off he goes again. I should mention that there are 2 proms to look forward to tomorrow evening here on BBC Radio 3. A celebration of British light music from Bantock to Walton with the BBC Concert Orchestra, conducted by Barry Wordsworth. That's at 7. I'll be back to present the late prom at 10:15. Minimalism meets satirical rock opera. The Aurora Orchestra giving the UK premiere of Philip Glass's 10th Symphony, a study by Conlon Nancarrow, and then music by Frank Zappa. It's going to be a memorable evening for sure. Well, so's this one. I think we're about to get some more music. What's the betting? It's in C major. The finale of Mozart's Jupiter Symphony, number 41, in C major, of course. A perfect encore for this evening's prom from the Mahler Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Daniel Harding, who's off to conduct the Verbier Festival Orchestra in another Mozart piano concerto this coming Saturday, back here at the proms on the 20th of August to conduct what's become the memorial prom for Sir Colin Davis, Tippett, Britten and Elgar. Well, the Mahler Chamber Orchestra has a break now until its own Lucerne Festival in mid-August, when it's the core of the Lucerne Festival Orchestra. Here in the hall, they've left us firmly in this evening's home key of C major, but are we about to modulate? Let's find out. Back in Broadcasting House, here's Ian Skelly.
Andrew, thank you very much indeed. We're heading towards F, in fact, but that's in a little while's time. Andrew McGregor at the Royal Albert Hall with tonight's BBC Prom. You can hear that concert again tomorrow afternoon in the next of our Prom's repeat programmes during Afternoon on 3 with Penny Gore. That begins at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, or, of course, online if you have access to the internet. It's there for the next 7 days on the iPlayer radio. As is our late prom from last night, which is well worth a listen to if you missed it. An extraordinary array of musical instrument sounds, all made by the human voice, the voices of the a cappella group Naturally Seven, which ran through a host of hit songs and some of their own material to a very appreciative and supportive audience last night. The Radio 3 website will guide you to all of the information and to all of the listen again options. Well, as Andrew was mentioning there just before that encore, we have two proms tomorrow night. We'll be teaming up with BBC Radio 2 for a simultaneous broadcast. There's a name from the past. Live from the Royal Albert Hall, Radio 2 and Radio 3 will be there. Petroc Trelawney from Radio 3 and Ken Bruce from Radio 2 to bring you a night of light music with the BBC Concert Orchestra conducted by Barry Wordsworth. We'll all be there live precisely at 7 o'clock tomorrow evening. And then that late prom, very different music indeed from the light music of the first prom, Frank Zappa's music and Conlon Nancarrow, his extraordinary Experiments for Player Piano, as it's called. If you've never heard one of those before, it's definitely worth tuning in for that, and a chance to hear a brand new symphony by Philip Glass, the UK premiere of his 10th symphony. That's our late prom tomorrow night. It begins at 10:15, and that's here on the home of the BBC Proms, BBC Radio 3. Well, a very good evening to you from me, Ian Skelly. We have a little more from the proms at just after 10:10 tonight. We have the next in our series of proms plus late events. The folk ensemble called Tia Olas has an interesting lineup of instruments: a flute, percussion, a guitar, a viola and a whistle, as well as vocals. They were all at the Royal College of Music last week, and we were there to record them, plus also poetry readings as well. You can hear that programme at just after 10:10 tonight. Then we celebrate the magic and perhaps also the mystery of the nonsense poet Edward Lear. It was his bicentenary last year, and there's a chance to hear one of the programmes that we made to mark that fact. The first in a series of essays which takes a closer look at Edward Lear's life and his work. Tonight, was he more a tragicomic rather, than a straight comedian? If that isn't too much of a oxymoron. How Pleasant to Know Mr. Lear is the title of the series, and the first of them is tonight at 11:45. Then at 11, music recorded at the weekend amid the showers during this year's WOMAD Festival. It dominates the first of this week's editions of Late Junction. That's with Fiona Torkington at 11 o'clock tonight. Programmes for the rest of the evening here on Radio 3. That's one of the tracks from a new CD that Petrarch Trelawney featured this morning on Breakfast here on Radio 3. He runs down the top 10 in the classical music chart every Tuesday morning just after the news at 8, and that has just entered the chart. It's a CD called Pocket Symphonies, and it's by the Fauré Quartet and the MDR Radio Symphony Orchestra of Leipzig. The music is by Sven Helbig, who calls the tracks 12 snapshots of a lonesome soul ending a day. 12 evening moods in different colours, he says. Well, that track was called Gone. Well, let's continue that reflective mood now with music of an English frame of mind. In 1927, Gerald Finzi embarked on a process of composing a piano concerto, which he never completed. All he managed to produce was the slow middle movement, which has since taken on a life of its own as a standalone concert piece. It finally saw the light of day some 25 years after Finzi had begun it. He wasn't a fast worker, And he never actually heard it played in his lifetime. He died just a couple of years after he finally signed this piece off. He called it the Eclogue for Piano and Strings, and it's a rather elegant and reflective span of music. Makes you wonder what the rest of the piano concerto would have sounded like had he completed it. Peter Donohoe is the pianist here. The Northern Sinfonia is conducted by Howard Griffiths.
Thank you.
That was the Eclogue for Piano and Strings by Gerald Finzi, played by the pianist Peter Donohoe, with Howard Griffiths conducting the Northern Symphonia. Plenty of English music in tomorrow's first visit to the BBC Proms. Granville Bantock, Elgar, Arnold, Walton and Coates, all played by the BBC Concert Orchestra, and the first prom to appear on BBC Radio 2 as well. That's here on the home of the BBC Proms, Radio 3, 7 o'clock tomorrow night. Earlier in the day, we'll be paying another visit to the Cheltenham Festival in our lunchtime concert. Tomorrow, a combination of chamber music and song. The Spanish mezzo Claudio Moriz and the pianist Joseph Middleton team up, as they have done several times during her tenure on the Radio 3 New Generation Artist Scheme this year. They'll be performing music by Ravel, and then the Signum Quartet plays the second of Benjamin Britten's string quartets. That's at 1 o'clock tomorrow lunchtime in our lunchtime concert here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, hello there, lovely listener. D-Love here again. Back to share the love for digital radio on BBC Radio 3. Tell me, can you think of anything better than listening to your favorite music on the radio? I can. Listening to your favorite music online in glorious HD sound. That's right. You could listen to the Proms online, giving your favorite music the HD treatment it deserves. Do the right thing. Share the love.
If you love radio, go digital. To listen to the Proms live in HD sound, visit the BBC Radio 3 website and click on Listen Live.
Always nice to hear from the controller of Radio 3. It's now just after 10:15. Time for us to go back to the Proms, in fact, and a Proms Plus late event of music and poetry that was recorded last week at the Royal Albert Hall. Here's Georgia Mann to introduce it.
Hello and welcome to this evening's Proms Plus Late, where we are settling back for some post-prom poetry and music upstairs in the Elgar Room at the Albert Hall as the night draws in behind these wonderful arched windows. And our band this evening actually formed about 3 years ago, just across the road from where we are now at the Royal College of Music. Tir Eolus are a folk band who have really drawn on traditions around the world to forge a very distinctive sound, which we'll be hearing plenty of, and we'll be hearing them giving us traditional music as well as their own music, and plenty of it too. And our poet tonight is Richard O'Brien, who I must say describes himself as a decreasingly young poet, performer and dilettante. And I'm not going to attempt a better introduction than that, but I can tell you that he won the Foyle Young Poets of the Year award twice. He was part of the South Bank Centre's record-breaking Poetry Parnassus, which was a huge festival of the spoken word. And when he's not involved in poetic exploits, he blogs for the Huffington Post and is currently in the throes. Well, in fact, he's actually just finished his first novel. And we'll be hearing from Richard very soon. But before that, it's Pip Mercer, Rory Glasheen, Laura Snowden and George Harris. And this is Tir Eolus.
Plea to future philanthropists. Dear sir/madam, permit me to dispense with the delicate dance, the stately sidle up to the tablature of talent, bills, and rent, the awkward pseudo-bridal courtship of the court short and the idle, and in its place submit a simple plea, a free-from-frills request. Invest in me. But first, a test. Let's get our money's worth. I'd like a full account of who you are. A tender-hearted thug, salt of the earth or landed, underhanded, oiled from cars, a quaffer of champagne or caviar. There are some caveats one ought to factor in when getting into bed with benefactors. What exactly are we all together in? If one of us has to be patronized and it's the turn of capital to captain, then it's prudent to ensure we won't capsize. Do any of the following apply? Consorting with consortiums, ex-cons, funding hedges I can't prick my finger on, or money sunning in some beach retreat, technical virgin undeclared in Kent. With so much hanging in the balance sheet, there is an ocean between broke and bent. So when all's said and spent, if you can outsource creativity to your accountant, then you don't need me. You don't need me. I'm ornament, gold leaf, no more essential than a mounted moose, a taxidermist you can tax relief, gift aid against a gift with no clear use. What have you got to lose? preserve me. For a reasonable price, I'll preserve you. I'll bring my own supplies if you've a spare wing you could take me under. My jotting pad, a pack of Bics, my wits. Keep me in tea. I'll try to show you wonders beyond any public-private partnership. And by the muse of calculated risk, if you stand back, resist the urge to edit, I'll do my best to bring us both some credit.
Richard O'Brien, more from him anon. Pip, hello.
Hi.
Just a quick word. Now, first of all, Tyrolus.
Yep.
Gorgeous sounding name. It's quite poetic in itself. Where does it come from? What is this thing, Tyrolus?
Well, it's Gaelic, and it was Rory's great idea to come up with this name for the band, and it actually means sort of land, like information about the land, land information.
Land information. Yeah. Sounds slightly bureaucratic. Yeah. You can maybe imagine a council has a file labelled this, but not obviously in Irish. So, as we said before, you met across the road, Royal College of Music.
Yep.
Do you get a happy twinge, a warm feeling coming here tonight, just across the road where you all met?
Yeah, very much so. It's really nice to be back, and we rehearse in college still, so it's always a nice feeling of sort of coming home.
So you're still very much connected.
Yep.
So we're going to be hearing your own music, as I've said earlier, but I just wondered, when you're choosing the traditional songs, the one that we heard you sing before, She Walks Through the Fair, I mean, when you approach those, what makes you think that's a Tyrolus song? We can really do something with that. We can really get our teeth into it. What's the criteria that you look for?
I'm not sure there's necessarily a set criteria. I think it's mainly about what we each love, because part of why we chose the name was because we're all from different places and we all know folk music from around the world. And we're trying to sort of merge that all together. So it's not necessarily like a criteria, but what we love. And then we try it and see what ideas we all bring to a new arrangement together and try and hopefully come up with something new and exciting.
It certainly is. And you're going to be doing us next a piece composed by Laura.
Yep.
And this is Ida.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about what we're about to hear.
Well, Ida was written by Laura after reading a book.
Yes, a book called No Roof in Bosnia.
That's
which is about a group of refugees who are escaping a civil war, and they come across a lady in a deserted village who hides them and saves their lives.
Great story. Guys, take it away. Thank you.
Thanks.
Seasons and seas apart, lady, to you I owe my freedom.
This poem that I'm going to read now was inspired by an episode of Radiolab, which is an American kind of pop science podcast. And they're talking about the idea of colour and how human beings generally have three cones in their eyes for the perception of colour. I'm not a scientist, but I'm fairly sure that that's within the bounds of my knowledge. They have cones to detect red, blue, and green, essentially. And they were speculating about what it might be like if a person had a fourth cone in their eyes. What kind of colours would they see, and how would they be able to even describe them to people who didn't have that capacity? And this poem came out of that. So I was telling a friend about it, and he suggests I call it Cone-Eyed Girl, which would have been funny, but also illogical, because everyone has cones. This person just has more cones. So the name for someone who has four cones in their eyes, if they existed, would be a tetrachromad. So this is a poem about someone who sees things in a different light, and it's called Four-Coned Ruth. Ruth was a tetrachromad in a small town by the sea, which meant she saw a colour more than her neighbour's eyes could see, or rather, more than a colour more than the common red, blue, green. She saw the shades those mixtures made and the secret shades between. So red for Ruth had a glint of green, green was a grade of red, and yellow grew from the bluest blue like flowers from the dead. If in every lie lay an anagram which assembled spelt the truth, that was the way the world conveyed its light to four-coned Ruth. But Ruth kept quiet mostly in that small town by the sea. One didn't boast about the almost extrasensory. See, what was known was what was felt, and what was seen made sense, and sense was shared. People were scared of Ruth. She made them tense. By implication, all their lives they'd seen the rainbow wrong, or not enough. If her cones were buds on wagging small town tongues, water would taste like sparkling wine, sweet wine like dry vermouth. You would be thirsty, fit to burst, if you were four-coned Ruth. Let's say she took a lover, Ruth, in that small town by the sea. And for argument's sake, and to up the stakes, let's say that it was me. And suppose her skin was as sensitive as her irises to light, then twice as much. Dark doubles touch. We only met at night. Then imagine a feeling next to which the time's all tension spilled to a shiver so pure it verged on air would seem like a dentist's drill to a patient without anesthesia turned in a rotten tooth. Let's say my body felt that way in the arms of four-coned Ruth. Or so she'd tell me when we met in that small town by the sea, where the sky would spit and us within it, iridescently. But Ruth grew tired, eventually, of the limits of my view. I guess we saw things differently, as lovers sometimes do. And lasers can't correct all defects. Trust me, friends, I've tried. Or even most. But come close. Closer. Look into my eyes. If you believe, for confirmation. If you don't, for proof. You'd see what's hid beneath these lids if you were four-coned Ruth. Thank you. The title of this poem is The Smell of Apples, and it has an epigraph which explains it a bit. It's from the book of Sir John Mandeville, which is a wholly spurious work of medieval travel literature. It's a kind of 14th century trip advisor. If you wanted advice on a trip that you could never take because the place it is going to doesn't exist and none of the people it talks about ever existed either because they're biologically impossible. This is The Smell of Apples. Oh, give me the thread from the hem of your dress that you caught in St. James's Park, and give me the blank in the blink of your eyes before they adjust to the dark, and give me the space in the skin of your throat that you smooth away with a breath, and the infinitesimal decimal points between your tongue and your teeth. Then give me the drip of a droplet of water that found its way down through your hair, and give me the light that your body divided and spread like a sodium flare. Now give me the dust that you brushed from your jeans in the chairs in the station cafe, and give me the spark that was spat from the track of the train that took you away, and give me the dot on the eye in the map of the village where you live, the cross of the T in a neighboring town, if it's all you've got to give. And then give me a signal, a cipher, a sign, a trinket, a token, a ring, and I'll follow it blind to the base of your spine, and I'll give you everything.
Thanks. Rurik Glashin, I'm going to ask you to show me your bairon now. What's a bairon?
A bairon is a traditional Irish frame drum, and it probably originally came from Africa. Nobody really knows. And the skin is made out of a goat, not living goat, a dead goat.
Are you sure?
And it's quite modest, and it's just a little wooden frame. And then you have a little stick called a tipper, which you beat it with.
And when did the bairon first come to pass for you?
I was very young. I was about four, and then I played until I was about four and a half, and then I stopped until I was about 18.
And then you just couldn't keep away?
Yeah,
back
indeed.
To the bairon. So tell us what you're going to be playing for us next.
So this is a traditional Irish song called She'd a Woman Away, which translates to something like The Wealthy Widow, and it's about a wealthy widow. It's from the west of Ireland, and it's usually sung unaccompanied, but we got into the spirit of it, and we all got involved, a bit of the action. So this is She'd a Woman Away.
She'd a woman away, she'd a woman, 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 she'd She's shooting, you know, rather cool, need a she's shooting, she got like an attic. Oh, she the one more, she the one more, she the one more, she got like an attic. She the one more, she won this water. Got a nigga, she had a rock, a shadow. Oh, Massin do votes, Massin do votes, Massin do votes, a guy like a Nerdicate. Toss him the votes, toss him the votes, and shine shame as smart, I guess, mine and he got sick. Go! She the one more, she the one more, she the one more, she got like a Nerdicate. She the one more, she won this war, got a Nika, she a rock, a shadow. Skadigavoski, 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 one more, and she did one more, and she did one more, she got a Connecticut. She did one more, she brought in the shortest. Got a Nika, she had a rock, she had a go. Mustn't do votes and mustn't.